Senator Booker, welcome to WBGO. Thank you for joining us and thank you for your time.
Listen, I owe this station so much from my most formative years till now. You guys have been a mainstay in my life and in the community and frankly, around the world.
All right. Well, that's true. We do have a worldwide listenership. There's so many things I could ask you about, Corey. I want to just start with your assessment of the current state of our American democracy and take that in whatever direction you'd like.
Well, I think we're a democracy in crisis. And it's not all the time of we're in right now, this first 110 days of Trump. But I think we began seeing real signs of crisis during Citizens United, when ungodly amounts of money, billions of dollars, have now been flooding into our political systems. And that's been abused by billionaires and large corporations who I've watched the change of the last decade in how money is corrupting our politics. It's one of the reasons why we stopped many years ago taking corporate cash or anything like that, because we wanted to be above that. I think we're in a crisis when senators trade stocks and do things that really abuse, I think, the positions we have. And there's no greater abuse right now than being seen with crypto and what the President of the United States is doing with this, to me, flagrant corrupt violation of the Emoluments Clause and created a meme coin where he is just allowing foreign nations to dump cash into his pocket. I think we're a nation in crisis when you see the due process rights of individuals in our country being so viciously violated, and people are being disappeared off of our sidewalks. And even when the Supreme Court says in a 9-0 decision that someone like Kilmar Abrego-Garcia should be here, the president does nothing, not only in continued violation of due process, but also in violation of the mandates of a court. I think we're a democracy in crisis when you see the separations of powers being eroded and a president is de facto impounding money that was approved for communities like ours in Newark, where you see funding for violence interruption going to grassroots communities who are showing the ability to lower violent crime, suddenly having those grants frozen by an executive branch that has no authority to do so. I think we're seeing a democracy in crisis when you have a president who is eroding civil rights protections by getting rid of entire divisions. I think we have a democracy that's in crisis when a president's deciding to get rid of entire agencies with executive fiat, even though they were created by Congress, like the Department of Education or the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. There are so many signs that our democracy is in crisis. And I think perhaps the test is going to be, what do we do in a crisis? Do we normalize all of this behavior that smacks of authoritarianism, where an executive is defying both the judiciary branch as well as the legislative branch? Or do we as Americans do what we've done in past crises and take it upon ourselves to engage in the work of a democracy, which is fighting to protect our democratic principles, like we saw in so many movements past, so many incredible exhibitions of public protest, public dissent, and ultimately the public proving in times of crisis that the power of the people is greater than the people in power.
It would seem that the courts, the judicial branch, is the branch of government that is, as of now, upholding our democracy from the Supreme Court on down. I've said for a while now that our democracy may end up coming down to two people, John Roberts and Amy Coney Barrett. My question to you is, what is your sense of where Republicans are in Congress right now who see the same thing that you and I see? Where are they? And at some point, are they going to take a stand?
Well, one, the courts are good, but not enough. And we saw that with Brown versus Board of Education. It's a landmark decision, but you still had it being violated in states around the country. And it took Congress and the executive branch to do more, ultimately, to win and secure civil rights. So you're right. I have seen and been grateful for people like Amy Coney Barrett, which I think folks did not realize that in the balance she would be standing up, as well as a lot of Trump-appointed judges who've been ruling against him. But your point about Congress right now is so disappointing to me, the complicity in the corruption that we're seeing by the president and the corruption of our democracy, and the fact that Republican House members and senators are doing very little is deeply disappointing to me. I have private conversations with folks who understand that there are things going on that are just wrong, but yet they're not doing their constitutionally mandated job of providing oversight or investigation or accountability or checks and balances to the executive. Things that should just stun the American public, that, like, for example, the national security breaches we saw in Signalgate, where our Secretary of Defense and other top national security people were using a commercially available app to communicate war plans, battle plans, attack plans. And we didn't hold one hearing in the Senate to investigate, is this a pattern? Is this a breach? What other types of breaches are going on? We did not see that very clearly we have tariff powers. It's not something that should be done under executive fiat without the Senate or the House doing their job. And yet we've had no hearings whatsoever when it comes to the policies that are driving up costs for Americans all over this country. I could go on and on and on about the Senate failing to do its job right now to check balance or provide oversight. So it's an unacceptable moment and time. We've seen this before, but I'm hoping that in time, with more and more public making it uncomfortable for congresspeople and senators, that they begin to do their job. I feel like Jefferson said it best, Thomas Jefferson, when he said, when the public fears their government, there is tyranny. But when the government fears its people, there is liberty. But right now, there are too many Republican House and senators who know what the right thing to do is, but they fear Donald Trump and the MAGA world more than they fear their own constituents, who they're often doing things that none of their constituents agree with, or few of them do.
I have to ask you about your 25 hours on the Senate floor. When you took the floor, did you anticipate talking for as long as you did?
Well, we didn't want to create the expectation that we would make it past the 24-hour and 18-minute mark, which was the record set by Strom Thurmond. I didn't know if I had the capabilities of doing it, but my team and I talked privately about, number one, disrupting the regular order of the Senate; two, talking as long as I was physically able; but three, we very much knew that that specter of the longest continuous speech in Senate history was done by a segregationist, an avowed segregationist, it trying to block civil rights. And I wanted that record. So I didn't want to announce it and create the expectation because I didn't know, but
Right.
I was very focused on trying to make it a full 24 plus hours.
And what was the overall message you wanted to send by taking the Senate floor for 25 hours? What would you like the headline of that 25-hour speech to be?
Well, I would say three things. One is that I was listening, that my constituents in New Jersey were right, that this was a crisis and I needed to do more, take more risks, stand up, and I wanted to let people know that I was listening. Number two, I wanted to center the voices of affected people. I wanted to tell the stories of folks who were being affected by the threats to Medicaid and Social Security and veterans benefits, the real stories of Americans that are not heard enough on the Senate floor, that I think too many people, too many of us suffer from a poverty of empathy to know that this is a crisis time for millions of Americans, for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of New Jerseyans who are facing a real pain and hardship because of the decisions being made by this executive. And then number three, I wanted to inspire other people to act as well, to understand that this is a moral moment, and that all of us had a responsibility to take action, greater action in the cause of our country, and in a time as urgent as this.
You mentioned the people of New Jersey, and of course, you were mayor of Newark for almost 2 terms. When you go home and you look around the city of Newark, what do you see? How do you assess the city itself? How's it doing?
Well, look, I'm proud of Newark. This is a city that, if you look at a larger span of history, so many people gave up on, so many people left. There was disinvestment and overtly racist policies that, like redlining and other sort of disinvestment, conscious disinvestment, that really punished our city. But yet, the folks who never gave up, who stood strong, who believed, who loved Newark and made investments and sacrifices, we have seen a city that not just only got off its knees from the 60s and 70s, but now is really striding forward. And I love that I see now, under the leadership of Roz Baraka, lots of people coming to Newark to see how we accomplished a lot of the things that we're accomplishing. So my experience as mayor is some of the work I'm most proud of in my life. You know, we were able to reverse a 60-year trend and have the population growing again after years, decades of more people leaving than coming in. Now people are voting with their feet, and our city's population is growing at a steady clip. We brought about the first, in fact, the biggest economic development boom in 60 years that this mayor is doing a great job in continuing, literally billions of dollars of investment as we see buildings and housing and supermarkets and more going up. We still have work to do, we still have challenges. As a city, but Newark is resilient, Newark is strong, and Newark is making a way out of no way. And frankly, I think Newark continues to show America that the American dream lives in our communities. It's worth fighting for. And we're going to show this country that nothing is impossible. You may not have believed in us, but we believed in ourselves, and we are doing great things in our city.
All right. So you referred to WBGO at the outset of your remarks. How did you become a WBGO fan, listener, and supporter?
Because my father was. You could not get in the car during a child. I grew up in Bergen County. I didn't come to Newark until the 90s. But when I would get into my car, WBGO would be on. I would hear that call sign, WBGO, Newark. And my dad loved jazz and loved this station. It was his station. I still remember when I got a chance to be a city council person and to go to WBGO with him and what it meant to him. And so my father was, both my parents were trailblazers. They moved into an all-white town, literally had to get a white couple to pose as them to buy the house. My father was and mother were trailblazers in a corporation that before them really didn't hire African Americans. Yet it was something about the culture, music, the kind of connection you get from radio that was always kept my parents healed, sourced, inspired, and fueled. And so part of the soundtrack of my family was this station. And it's why I love it so much. And I'm so grateful that as I became an adult, and especially as I became a city council person and mayor, I was able to sit in those studios, hold forums where people could ask me questions and engage with me. And to see that even though the media environment has changed so dramatically, to see WBGO still fulfilling its mission and still having its impact, as I said earlier, global impact. There are listeners around the world. And I know that there are millions of people that, like me, like my parents, have been sourced by this station, have had their souls sourced by this station for generations.
That's really terrific to hear. So my show includes interviews and classic R&B. My sweet spot is sort of late 70s, 80s. Have any favorite R&B artists from the period, Corey?
Well, I do. I just want to give a shout out to some of the great jazz classics. I discovered some of my favorite artists like Coltrane and Thelonious Monk on WBGO, but you're now speaking to maybe more of my sweet spot as a guy who was born in 69. And I can only hope that you play some Anita Baker, some Luther Vandross.
I just don't wanna stop. Too much, never too much, never too much, never too much.
That maybe even you go to some deep cuts, like some folks like the Brothers Johnson. I don't know if you go back there.
Red magic satin playing near, but two.
But these are folks that in the 70s and 80s really were my brother and I, that was the vinyl we brought into the house.
All right, Anita Baker, Luther Vandross, the Brothers Johnson. You got it, man. Thank you so much, Senator, for your time. I really appreciate it. I know you're busy in the midst of a very busy period in the United States Congress. We really appreciate your giving some time to WBGO.
Well, I appreciate you and repping WBGO, but you are a guy that is and has been consistently for most of my career. I've got a chance to watch and witness the good that you do, the justice that you stand for, the fights, the righteous fights that you take on. And so just know that I have such deep respect for you and gratitude for you, and on more than one occasion have leaned on your wisdom and your example. So thank you, my brother.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for joining us, Senator.
All right. Take care now.